to talk about is the following. How we use a deeper understanding of the Goldstein theorem and an unconscious matter system to mimic emergent quantum fields on an effective curved space-time, and how we can use this system where we naturally have a Lorentz symmetry breaking mechanism to look at issues for relevant for quantum gravity phenomenology. Or in simpler words, is we how can we generate massive phonon excitations, and what happens if these phonon excitations high energy become transphononic? And this work has been done together with Stefano Liberati and Matt Wisson. So, do you have a laser or only this? Okay, thank you. So first I say a few words about emergent spacetimes and why emergent spacetime, if you look at a Bose-Einstein condensate, for example, why the emergent spacetime picture is just another way to look at the condensate. Then I present how can you extend this class of analog models with emergent spacetime to obtain massive excitations on your emergent spacetime. And I also talk about the problem, as Matt pointed out already, if you have a more complicated system, you also extend the class of spacetime geometry such that you have to do some specific fine-tuning so that you have two excitations, a massive and a massless one, in a monometric spacetime scenario. And then we raise a question in this emergent spacetime, you naturally have Lorentz symmetry breaking. And the question is, if you have these classic excitations in, for example, in your Bose-Einstein condensate at one hand, and on the other end of the scale in the ultraviolet, you have these fundamental atoms, do you get some imprints of the microscopic substructure on your collective excitations? So what kind of dispersion relation do you actually get? And the last thing is, can we learn anything, or can we compare what we get from this specific analog model for our models suggested in quantum gravity phenomenology. Okay, let's start. So first, I say a few things about emergent spacetimes. I say, in what sense are these spacetimes emergent? What they are emerging from? And I should like to stress that this is a toy model. So this is not a real model in that sense for quantum gravity. I present a model that really exists, a condensed matter system, a gas an ultra-cold gas of atoms, and how from this, if you look at the Bose-Einstein condensate, how you can interpret that as a space-time geometry. So I say a few words about the concept of immersion. Then I say a few things about the analog models for gravity in general. What is behind analog models for gravity? And last but not least, I point out what I mentioned in the beginning, these two sides of a coin. You have the inner and outer observer. And the inner observer is the one that experiences the emergent spacetime, while the outer observer is in the prepared frame. So emergent in the sense that you start from a microscopic system of fundamental objects, so they can be anything, so strings, atoms, or molecules. In our case, it's atoms, it's bosons, and that is the most fundamental description for the system. Then you also need some regime where the microscopic degrees of freedom describing the atoms are replaced by macroscopic variables describing this dominant mean field. So in our case, this will be the Bose-Einstein condensate. And it's important that not any system can be used as an emergent spacetime, but what you also need, you need to have some sort of geometrical object so you can rewrite the kinematic equation for this system for small excitations around your dominant mean field regime, such that these small perturbations are dominated by this geometrical object. So this is then, in our case, to mimic general relativity, it should be a symmetric tensor, symmetric rank 2 tensor, that dominate the quantum excitations. And the last point is then, because you have more, so this mean field, of course, it's higher energy breaks down. There's something below this. There's a microscopic substructure. And so this is, at the end, we need this part or this fundamental principle of all these analog models to get the Lorentz symmetry breaking into the game. So first, one of the most it's studied in depth is about the Einstein condensate. So we start with a gas of ultra-cold bosons. They're weakly interacting, so that you only have two particle coalitions. So you say in this regime you don't form molecules whatsoever. You only have elastic coalitions. It's easy to study this system. It's well understood in theory. So you have your fundamental Hamiltonian has a kinematic term, it's a trapped gas of atoms, and you have these two particle coalitions. Notice that this Hamiltonian is invariant under, if you replace, has an SO2 symmetry under an arbitrary phi. So it has this fundamental Hamiltonian exhibits an SO2 symmetry. So next step is, as I said, when you form the condensate, when you cool down this gas of atoms in an appropriate way, so that they're not liquefied, so what you get is you form a the condensate cloud. And what that actually means, you break this SO2 symmetry. So that the condensate now has a non-zero expectation value. And the condensate itself is represented by two physical variables. So that's the density of the condensate and the phase. So the condensate, Bose-Einstein condensate, is characterized by a density and a phase. And if you now look at this, that's representing your Bose-Einstein condensate, you can now study small perturbation in the system by linearizing around the density and the phase. And you can, after some calculation, you can rewrite this linearization. So you have this theta is now the perturbation in your phase, and you get two equations. Two coupled equations, and you can eliminate the perturbation of the density and rewrite the kinematics for the perturbation in the phase of the condensate in this specific way. So, and that is nothing else than that's a free field equation for a spin zero massless particle, so a scalar field, in an what this GIB represents, it's an emergent space time. And this is characterized by the macroscopic variable, so that's the speed of sound and the background velocity of the condensate. So the background velocity of the condensate is a gradient of the phase of the condensate, and the speed of sound is proportional to the density of the condensate. So as we can see, this collective excitations in the phase of the condensate is governed by an emergent spacetime, which exhibits is built up from the collective variables. So we're in a regime clearly where we eliminated the microscopic degrees of freedom. So how good a model can, when is this analysis actually a good analysis? So when can I use this equation to describe my excitation in the condensed matter system? And the answer is pretty simple, because this is something that comes from the linearization process. And there's a really nice paper out there by Carlos Bacello, Stefano Liberati, and Matt Visser, where they studied what is necessary actually to get this notion of space-time geometry, emergent space-time geometry, as a result of the resulting from the linearization around some background field. And the point is here, these analog models are good are appropriate to describe your condensed matter system if you can actually do this linearization process. This means if you have small excitations and you can neglect back reaction effects. So in the same sense, if you do quantum field theory in curved spacetimes, what do? You do semi-classical quantum gravity without including back reaction effects. So in some sense, these analog models are derived under the premises, under the same premises as you apply quantum field theory in curved space-time without back reaction. So what I mean if I talk about an inner and outer observer? So So if you look at that, that's also mentioned today. This is phase contrast imaging mapping of a condensate cloud. So this is a condensate cloud at different time steps. So time goes in this direction. And what you see, these red dots, is how sound waves actually in this condensate propagate. And you see that, so sound waves in condensate have been measured. And this sound waves in your condensate, these are the inner observers. They experience an effective correct space-time. There's, on the other hand, the outer observer, which is, for example, it's a living in the lab frame, which looks at this condensate, and it's, for that, it's a Bose-Einstein condensate. And you have these parameters in terms of lab time. So you're in this preferred time, you have an absolute time, and that's the time with which you change, for example, the interactions of this condensate, the atoms in the condensate. So the question is it possible actually to extend this class of analog models for massive excitations? Is it possible to give the phonon motor mass? And for that, you need to look back. You can play with symmetry. So what you need, a deeper understanding of the Goldstone theorem helps you to sort of find a way out to which first looks like very the Goldstone theorem predict this massless excitations, but by coming up with a more complicated or more fancy system, you can actually use Goldstone theorem to come up with a mass generating mechanism. So just again, so this picture has been shown before by Matt. So the first analog model was actually derived by Bill Andrew, where he looked at sound waves in a barotropic inviscidant irritational fluid, and he found this analogy. And so the question is, actually many people studied as used to these analog models, for example, to mimic Hawking radiation or cosmological particle production and so ever. But now we're focusing on the whole kinematic equations and try to get the mass term here. And so this is the question. And for that, we look first at the Goldstone theorem. It says, whenever, because we know more about the system, we know where we started from the microscopic description, and we know there is a spontaneous symmetry breaking in the system, and the Goldstone theorem predicts massless boson emergence in the system. So any excitation should not have a gap. So a dispersion relation should be gapless. But it is possible actually to circumvent that by looking at a more complicated system. So what we're doing is now we take, in some sense, we take a condensate that has atoms in two different hyperfine states. So what it basically is, you have two Bose-Einstein condensates. So you have A and B. And each of them actually, when you start from the microscopic description and you form your Bose-Einstein condensates, each of them has an SO2 symmetry. But if you couple these two condensates with transitions between them, so because you have two different hyperfine states, so if you look at it, so these are the two different hyperfine states, and you can drive transitions between these states such that they're represented in this term, and this term now explicitly breaks the symmetry. Represents an explicit symmetry breaking, such that you now, instead of having two symmetries in your Hamiltonian, you're left with one simultaneous symmetry for the whole system. So, and this is the transition. So now the point is here now, the Goldstone theorem says whenever you have, if you now form, starting from this microscopic system, if you then build the condensate, if you have this phase transition, you again have a spontaneous symmetry breaking, but the Goldstone theorem only predicts one massless number Goldstone boson emerging. So meaning, since we now have a two-component system, I have two excitations, clearly. And only one of them has to be massless, so the second one is now allowed to be massive. But for that, you need to actually play around with the symmetries, because if you wouldn't have this tuning, you just would break two symmetries. So you would have two spontaneous symmetry breaking, and you would have end up with no mass effect citation. So it is crucial to manipulate the fundamental symmetries of the system in order to be able to have this freedom for the second excitation to be massive. Okay, so I think there will be Florian will talk about Finsler spaces, and so I think there will be some more talks about that. I don't want to say much about it. I only want to say, as also Matt pointed out, this is a very rich system, and you can think of it in the following way. You can say, well, each of these condensates, as we know it from the inner observer, from a linearized perturbation in the system, represents an emergent spacetime. So now I have two emergent spacetimes, and they're even coupled with each other. So in some sense, it is natural why you can understand why this system is much more complicated. So in some sense, you have these this Finsler geometry, which represents, so in the blocks, on the block diagonal, you see this is the spacetime geometry of the condensate A, and the other one will be of condensate B. And you have these off-diagonal 4x4 matrices, which in some sense couple this spacetime geometry. So what we want to do is we want to find an analog model for our world. We want to simplify this model. And the way to do it is you use the condensate parameter to tune down from Pseudo to Finsler to bimetric to monometric. So what it does actually, going from Pseudo to Finsler to bimetric, you make this off-diagonal block zero. So then you have a bimetric system. This means you have excitation with different sound speeds, which represent the light speed of light here in our analog model. And if you further wanna get a monometric structure, you have to adjust. These two things must represent, see, the same spacetime, so the blocks are identical. The parameters, so you see, for example, here, to go from pseudo-Finsler to bimetric, you have to set these are condensate parameters. So what you tune actually is use are the interactions between the atoms. These are the interactions, the effective interactions, which are functions of the interactions between the fundamental atoms and the laser coupling, which drives the transitions.
Of course, this is severe fine-tuning.
Right.
Exactly. Real theory of quantum gravity.
You're right. So,
what? Quantum corrections. Are you sure that this maintain that quantum correction? This conditions that it would your coupling should depend on energies or something.
You mean that there are enough degrees of freedom to do that? Yes, we've checked it.
Perfect.
So there are enough degrees of freedom to adjust it. Is that doable in an experiment? But actually, I want to say something different to that. This is a very negative way to look at it. It's a good question, but the point is here is maybe not. The point here is, if you look at that, so without any tuning, does that actually represent something? And the answer is yes. It's a pseudo-Finsler spacetime. Might be quite complicated, but nevertheless, it's an analog model for a pseudo-Finsler spacetime, which means it's not just a big mess. It's already something, a geometrical object, which I find very interesting, actually. So this system is much richer, actually, than reality. If you want to be
I
worked on that, so I have to say it then. So the point is now, once we agreed on this, you have to do a very fancy fine tuning, and however, if you like it or not, we are now in this regime and we have a monometric spacetime with two excitations. So now the question is, how does the now I want to study the equation, the kinematic equations for my perturbation in the system. And what I get is actually, I get, as expected, one massless mode because of the Goldstein's theorem. And I get one massive mode. So we achieved what we originally started with, and it's kind of easy to understand, actually. So what you have is, of course, you have an inverse. So if you look at these excitations, if you have a single condensate, and you look at the excitation, you have one way to excite it. If you have this coupled two condensates, there are two ways to that these perturbations are coupled. One is in phase, which represents my massless excitation, and the other one is when they are out of phase, so an anti-phase. So we have these two excitations in our system. One is always zero, and the other one is proportional to lambda, which makes sense because lambda is this how I couple these two space-time geometries, and I said if that is zero, because of the Goldstein theorem, both modes have to be massless modes. So it's actually exactly what we expected. And what we see, one can play further tricks because, of course, you have more than two hyperfine states. You can couple different hyperfine states, and in general, you can think about very easily how you can generate different masses in your system. But of course, the fine-tuning and everything involved with it gets more and more complicated. So far I said for emergent spacetimes, we found a model that has all these features. So we have some microscopic degrees of freedom. We have a regime where we replace the microscopic degrees of freedom with a dominant mean field regime. We've seen that this dominant mean field regime for an inner observer in this condensate is dominated by a geometrical object which can be interpreted as an emergent spacetime geometry. And so now there's one thing left. And of course, as I said, every analog model in some sense must have some Lorentz symmetry breaking. And that is quite obvious, because if you go to higher energy, eventually go back to where you started from, and that's a microscopic substructure. You need to see there must be something beneath that. There must be something that's sort of more fundamental than your mean field. So we look at these models are ideal test candidates to look at Lorentz symmetry breaking. So we say, so quantum gravity phenomenology, one big issue is the Lorentz symmetry breaking. So we say, I show how in a Bose-Einstein condensate the Lorentz symmetry breaking mechanism, how it works, or why it's there, and also why these Lorentz symmetry breaking terms in some sense interpolate between this collective excitation and microscopic degrees of freedom. So I think for this conference it's kind of pointless to explain you what's quantum gravity phenomenology. I work a lot with condensed matter physicists, and I find the whole area of quantum gravity phenomenology kind of amusing, because they say there's nothing such like phenomenology of Bose-Einstein condensate, because it's not an extra field. So here, in the sense that if you deeply think about the fact that we need our own research area for quantum gravity phenomenology, it means that quantum gravity is not in real good shape. It's summarized all possible effects or measurable effects of quantum gravity. And there are one big major study is studying the Lorentz symmetry breaking at high energies. And there's a really nice living review on the net. And basically, you have two different kinds of Lorentz symmetry breaking. One is the presence of a preferred frame. And the other one is, for example, you have equal frames, but the transition laws between the frames are modified. So for example, W special relativity. And so analog models are all, in a sense, I haven't seen an analog model for the second one, but analog models always end up in the preferred frame in a sense that you see what is beneath it. So how is it working in the VEC? If you look at the dispersion relation, which has been measured in Bose-Einstein condensate, so if you look at the Bogoliubov dispersion relation, then you see that first you have a linear part, and then it gets off quadratic. So this has been measured. So what it means is actually for the macroscopic variables, if you have low energetic excitations in your condensate, you see that if you have a sound wave propagating almost all of them with a constant speed of sound. And at the higher energies, what you recover in your dispersion relation is actually the free is the kinetic energy of an individual boson. So in some sense, if you look at this dispersion relation, it really interpolates between these macroscopic sound wave collective variables and the microscopic degrees of freedom.
When one says, in this regime I have Lorentz symmetry, and one looks at the dispersion relation, that is one aspect of the Lorentz invariance. But in that level, I should also have a frame independence of the interactions. So have people also consider what is, let's say, the scattering cross-section of these different type of particles or excitations in the low wavelength regime, and shown that that is independent of the velocity of the excitations with respect to the underground, to the underlying fluid?
Well, in some sense, so you say, well, this is only for inner observer, for excitations in my condensate.
Right. And then, so I scattered two of those excitations in the condensate.
Okay, so...
Is the scattering cross-section independent of the velocity of those excitations with respect to the underlying fluid?
So I...
Actually, yes, that's what Keel and Carlos did with that little paper.
Okay.
I mean, people have gone through the trouble to ask, you know, suppose we had people built out of material held together by exchange of virtual phonons. And suppose they had rulers that were held together based out of virtual phonons. Mm-hmm. And they tried doing a Michelson Morley experiment with mm-hmm. all the sea. And they would not see the ether drift. Okay. So yeah, that can be checked.
Sorry, that might be more with phonon.
Well, that's the point is you need to have observers and equipment that's held up of a material that's held together by the virtual phonons that you're using to describe what you mean by Lorentz invariance. If you've got a ruler that's held together by electromagnetic stuff, that's seeing the metric that the laboratory is living in, and you're not going to see any sort of Lorentz invariance from that point of view. Okay? So it really has to be something built up out of the elementary quasi-particles we're dealing with.
But once you discuss with meters and clocks, which are made based on phonons, it's kind of obvious that you should find the Lorentz transformation. Remember the way they were introduced the first time? The basic idea at the time was exactly that there was a compensation. So you cannot see the edge of drift in that case. So you really recover the special relativity.
But it's not obvious. At least the bottom of this would work.
It does take a little bit of extra thinking, but there are some articles on that subject around. Of course, what is not obvious to me is, if I scatter the quantum, if I'm properly asymptotic states in the quantum theory, and there is the problem with excluding the electromagnetic interactions in the quantum, there is like confinement of quarks. The quarks are asymptotic states, I mean, there are, and when they are strong, so there are all these caveats, which I'm sure they can be resolved.
I don't want to sound negative. Just
okay.
The last point is what do you want to say there? Okay. So in some sense, all these analog models can be really viewed at that. Interpolating between these two different regimes. So in some sense, even so you have collective excitation, the microscopic substructure leaves some fingertips. And this can be recovered if you go to higher energies. And Matt talked about this in depth. So this is about actually condensate, or if you have an analog model in an electromagnetic waveguide. However different these models are, at the end of the day, if you look at them, you get some sort of k to the fourth correction. Maybe superluminal or subluminal, but it's a CPT invariant, so you get this k to the fourth corrections in many different analog models. So, of course, there are also some helium-4, for example, as pointed out by Stefano, where you get a k to the three corrections, however, this kind of correction seem to be, as Matt pointed out, quite likely to lead to a k to the fourth correction. Which, of course, here it's also obvious that we don't get a k to the three correction because we started with the fundamental Hamiltonian. It was invariant, CPT invariant. So, therefore, we don't expect it really here. So, and per definition, we have this preferred frame, which, because it's only an analog model, it's not real gravity. So now we want to combine that. We were able to get a massive phonon excitations, and we also want to see what happens if this phonon, a massive phonon excitation, get transphononic. So what we do for that, of course, we cannot forget that this system not naturally exhibits a monometric structure. So what we do, we include this what we call a quantum pressure term. I will come back to that and explain how you get this correction coming into our theory, how you can do how you can calculate the full dispersion relation for the condensed matter system. But the point is here, first, you need to have in mind that you still have to do this always, this tuning. You still need to do the fine tuning so that you're in this regime where you have your monometric analog space-time, and what you then do, you calculate high ultraviolet corrections in your theory.
What's wrong? Well, it seems that we live in a monometric structure.
Oh, yeah. Equivalent to what?
Sorry?
Experiment on so
forth. How do you know that the equivalent principle is valid?
I mean, we got an experiment.
No! Yeah, but
after
a point.
Yeah, absolutely.
After a point. That's what I'm saying. So you may not believe me. What is Bekenstein suggested that in order to evade the dark matter, we may have a biometric model. So,
we have the test of the difference between the speed of gravity and the speed of light, which is, with a mistake, the error, I think, is about, it was a paper by Carlin that was setting this number, I think about 1%.
Yeah, but suppose that the biometric differs by 1 over n Planck squared, which you would expect to be the...
But the problem is that these analog models typically need to order 1.
Yeah, okay. As far as the analog models are concerned, it's fine.
But anyway, I mean, the theory is very useful if you want to do very speed of light cosmologies.
Yeah,
it's not that a priori.
It's not that they're intrinsically dead, but they certainly require more thought about the observational situation.
So for now, we want to compare this, for example, dispersion relation you get from
non analyzable perspective. Right. No, that's true. That's certainly true. But for now, we want to restrict our analog model and ask specific for the dispersion relation what we get under this constraint.
Why are you going to shoot the insular?
Because you have negative distances.
That's your definition.
Yeah. So it's pseudo Riemannian.
Difference between Riemannian and pseudo Riemannian. Okay,
so we've done that. We've analytically calculated dispersion. I come back to the kind of corrections we included in the theory. But for now, I just want to say, so that's the dispersion relation we get. We were able to identify, so this is the full dispersion relation. So in the case for the massive mode, so this eta 2 is always the mass scale of the coarsest particle. So how heavy the quantum excitation is, divided by the effective planck mass. Effective planck mass. I come back to that. But so this is the correction we get here. And this eta 4 is, once you pull out this Planck suppression term, is of order 1 for both for the masses and the massive excitation. So again, eta 2, because 1 mass is over 0, is for the in-phase perturbation is 0. For the massive perturbation, it has this ratio between the mass of the coarser particle divided by the effective Planck mass. I come back to this. So this is very brief, but that's the dispersion relation we get, and I think that's a really surprising that it looks so simple and beautiful. Anyway, so first, so that's important. We have done all these calculations, which I actually haven't shown you, but you can read it in our papers. But the point here is, now we want to go back and study, but what is the nature of these non-perturbative corrections? Why they're non-perturbative, and how do we get them into the game? And then I want to say something about the naturalness problem in our condensed matter system, and also about the mass-generating mechanism in the Lorentz symmetry breaking, because we know already that well, I'll come back to that. So how all these things, how, for example, the Kohlstein theorem and this explicit symmetry breaking, how these effects are, what can we learn for the Lorentz symmetry breaking mechanism in our condensed matter system? So the nature of the work. So first of all, in order to get this regime, where our analog models for gravity were the good models for low energetic excitations. These are all made in the so-called hydrodynamic approximations. In the hydrodynamic approximation, you make it's pretty much if you have your condensate, that's like a two-dimensional condensate, and then you would have a scalar, a typical scalar of this condensate, which tells you what is the average length for density fluctuations to bulk out. So when is this mean field description actually a good description? And that is really
when, so you can sort of divide your condensate into cells where you say, so this is a, so in some sense this would be the smallest possible cell versus condensate to exist, so that the density fluctuation needs some space to average out. So if you then look at wavelengths that are larger than this spacing where the density fluctuations, where you have some rough, there's some roughness from the underlying substructure, when they, if the U excitation is larger than this, this volume, which is given, presented by the healing length, which shows up here. And so that's sort of like your division between phononic and transphononic modes. So this is, you can identify a scale in your condensate. So, and this means what you actually assume is that you have a perfect nice mean field approximation. But for higher energetic excitations, you need to include this into your theory. And this is just so, in some sense, if you look at your fundamental Hamiltonian and you plug in the Eichenholz approximation for your condensate cloud, so what you get is you neglect this term. So then you're in the hydrodynamic approximation. And so if you want to have these non-perturbative corrections into your theory, if you explicitly want to find a larger you want to have a theory that is also able to describe these wavelengths comparable to the healing lengths, then you need to include this term. So that's what we've done for our calculations. And so the healing length actually is given in terms of this epsilon quantum pressure. It's just h bar, and 2 times m is the mass of the fundamental bosons. And the healing length is given then as, this is sort of something from the microscopic substructure, and the C0 is the sound speed in the system. So in some sense, the speed of sound is dependent on the lab frame. So this healing length also is dependent on this preferred time. So, and again, now, so by including, by going this way, we need to include this quantum pressure term, how it's called, and we get this Lorentz symmetry breaking into our game. So what about the naturalness problem? So first of all, of course, what kind of modifications do we have? First, as mentioned again, so we don't have a k to the 3 term, which is not surprising. So the Lorentz symmetry breaking in our analog model is in the boost subgroup. It is non-perturbative. It's not a result from any tree-level calculation. It just comes that you include, you're not in the hydrodynamic approximation. So the next thing is the natural, so there is, in some sense, this eta 2 and eta 4 can be independently from each other, maybe small. So eta 4 is of order 1, once you pulled out this correction term, the Planck suppression, while eta 2 can be, depending on your coupling strings between these two condensates, can be made small independently of eta 4. So in some sense, you have a further suppression mechanism, a natural way to suppress eta 2, which is important because in experiments, the Lorentz symmetry, so far there are constraints from experiments, and it seems not that there is a correction term, Lorentz symmetry breaking term in the k to the 2 order. So, and the last thing is to mention maybe these eta 4 coefficients are different for the massless and the massive excitations if the two masses of the MA and MB are different. So that's the kind of corrections we get. And finally, so now we can say something about the mass generating mechanism and the Lorentz invariance violation. So everything comes back actually by enforcing some explicit symmetry breaking in our system, you generate a mass. At the same time, you also get eta two coefficients. But these eta two coefficients are naturally suppressed. So there is no naturalist problem in the system, and everything sort of goes back to this explicit symmetry breaking in your microscopic theory. And this thing, I haven't really talked about it, but our analog models also exhibit a rich geometrical structure. And that's it, and I would like to thank the organizers for having me.
Yeah, I I must say I like this model, so what I'm going to say doesn't represent it. Now, let me, okay, the important aspect in all analog models, which has been stressed by me, is that you have this referring time frame, which may not be a fundamental property of quantum gravity. I mean, I naively believe that in quantum gravity you don't necessarily have. Okay, let me reformulate my comment. From what you say is that if we accept Lorentz, if we accept that this analog model would represent somehow the microscopic world, necessarily I must have a Lorentz symmetry breaking in the microscopic system. Am I right? That's okay.
In the microscopic.
Now, however, this preferred time frame in the lab, in the real quantum gravity system might mean nothing, because in a real quantum gravity you have a background independent format, you should have in principle, right? I mean, your space-time should emerge without being immersed to anything else before, am I right? I mean, so the concept of coordinates, of time or of space, should not exist before the space. At least that's it's not a criticism of the analog models, maybe the deep.
No, but I think they are challenging that idea. Okay. If you take this seriously, you believe gravity is emergent, then you believe that there is some...
But that's exactly what I am saying. If I believe that quantum gravity is more than an emergent thing, one is the induced gravity, which we all have, but that presupposes that there exists an absolute frame in which, you know, this embedding is done. And that's why you do with your lab. So in other words, you have your lab, which is one form of space-time, right? Because you have a time, you have the real thing of time. Now, it's not clear to me that there is no analog system in which this lab time doesn't play a role.
Let me talk about this. So the point is actually, right, so the point also is this, what we call the leading edge, which is analog or symmetry breaking scale. In some sense, depends on its preferred time. So it can be time dependent. So what we studied in detail actually looked at cosmological part production, working two to a polarizing condensate, and we played around with the sound speed. So the distances propagate to long over time. So we've done with them, making the sound speed smaller and smaller and smaller. So signals would travel longer, longer, and longer for the same distances. So what happened in the system was, in order to enforce this cost, to get the freedom of the Walker space time coming up, we have to change the speed of sound. And whenever you do that, you change the healing length. So the healing length is same, is time dependent. In some sense, your fundamental or symmetry breaking scale, which means also a fundamental constants, whatever, is then considered to be time-dependent, which caused a lot of differences. So this means, because the analog model is, what you say, here we have a nice analog model, when you roughly all of the excitations experience the same speed of sound. But if you play around with this, the different, you know, the scale on which you leave this phononic regime, then what was phononic at some time, it's not phononic at later times. So actually this changes the power spectrum coming out, the particle production spectrum coming out of the system tremendously. So what our answer is only two models. If you could say any other model, and then you get, instead of the superluminal modification, get subluminal. So the point is, these analog models are four models. And what you have to look at them and say, I want to mimic something specific. And then what you do, you pick an analog model that's a good analog model for the effect you want to make.
I agree, but my point was different. My question was different. Is it possible that I find an analog model which, for instance, would, instead of your Schrödinger equation, because you use a Schrödinger equation for the Bose Einstein, use a Wheeler-DeWitt equation where the Hamiltonian is?
Yeah, you can also use a relativistic.
You can find it from surfaces. But is this time really essential for your.
A fair comment here, because so far I think you're misinterpreting this question. If you are serious about being an analog model based on condensed matter sort of approximation, then you've got a pre-existing time. And so, it's emergent in the sense that the yield geometry is emergent, thus it's out of something totally different. But you do have a pre-existing time and space for this whole thing.
Because you have your system there. So
some people would argue that is not truly emergent because you're not getting the whole manifold emerging out of nowhere. So, say the causal set theory is very different because you're really just starting from discrete points and building up the manifold. On the other hand, it is still truly emergent in the sense that you're seeing a space-time geometry that's not part of any individual sort of system. In the same sense, it's like hydrodynamics is emergent. Granted, you're starting from Newtonian physics for the molecular dynamics, and based on the Newtonian physics, the molecular dynamics, you then get this acoustic geometry dropping out. So it's truly emergent in that sense, but it's not emergent in the sense of your entire topological manifold emerging out of nowhere.
Which I would believe that the true problem.
Anyway, I can't just confirm. Most of the, in emergence, when you talk about emergent gravity, we have seen that, now people is proposing very often models of emergent gravity where you have an existing Hamiltonian, which is the answer. So there, once you have an Hamiltonian, you have a kind of absolute time. To me, the answer is, I cannot measure. This is a kind of auxiliary time that is not measured in the emergent system. In a sense, you can say the same thing here. Would a phononic observer observe the time of the lab, or would observe its relativistic time? So the other point is that what you're saying, that in truly, do we believe that that is the way gravity should emerge? That is the question. I think that you're right in the sense that if you do not want to have this auxiliary external time, if you like, absolute time, then you need to have a kind of non-dynamical system in the sense that the Hamiltonian must be seen.
Or a constrained system.
Or a constrained system.
That's what
right.
I'm getting.
Right.
A gauge
or
system. Something which the constraint is
certainly going to be something like a Schrodinger equation, I think.
Yeah. And a basic thing, of course.
In both cases, we want to also tell you it can even be fine to have a Schrodinger equation behind it if you cannot measure the absolute time as a phononic observer.
Was that the original question? Is that possible? Because it seems like every example I've ever heard of.
Yeah, that's what I asked.
Well, if you work with condensed matter model, the answer is basically impossible.
You always have a model
in which at most you can claim that it's an auxiliary time never tested by the phononic observer. But that is related to the fact that you're playing with a condensed matter analog. You have always to be careful to not buy the whole analog, but buy the part which are relevant to the insight you want to have. You cannot really, most of the people do not believe in a condensate in the true sense of the word.
With all of the analog models, the thing that is extremely difficult to get is something like the Einstein equation, something involving Richard tensor equals zero. I'll be babbling a little bit about that at the second conference. So I do not think you can get everything out of these analog models, but you can get a lot of useful insight.
No, absolutely. I don't disagree at all. It's just the concept that what I was asking is this Lorentz symmetry a must or not? And the answer is we cannot answer that because the angle model may be totally different as far as their micros, the other side, the blue side, in real gravity could be slightly different. Is that okay? Is that unacceptable? But the low energy phase?
As long as it's a hydrodynamic limit.
Yeah.
Okay, so you do want the phase velocity and the group velocity to agree with each other at low momentum. If you don't have that, then you do not have a meaningful notion of even low momentum space-time metric dropping out.
I still think though that biometric models or multimetric models might not be so unrealistic.
It's a rich structure, so you just have to look more carefully at the phenomenological constraints.
Well, may I add something else? One thing which is, I think, is quite appealing in analog model program is you have so many different analog models. You have more than only this condensed matter fluid analog models. You also have electromagnetic wave guidance and so forth. Nice thing is that in all these different models, you have this emergent space time, and all these modifications seem to be all not that that far off from each other. So in some sense, we have this generality, you see, this different system, which in some sense says, well, if you look maybe in effective field theories, whatever is quantum gravity, it seems that there is an easy way, to just, even if you don't know the whole truth, maybe to sort of come up with an effective field theory, which might not be so so much dependent on the real quantum gravity.
Sure, that's what I said, the low energy part would be fine.
Yeah, but you can saw this correction expression up here with your method.
Questions? Let me thank once more all the speakers of today for their beautiful and prepared talks, and wish you a nice evening and a good night.